From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump has struck his first major trade deal with South Korea. The agreement doubles the number of cars that each American automaker can export to South Korea, and it puts limits on imports of South Korean steel while exempting the country from the new tariffs that Trump imposed this month.
His supporters say Trump leveraged the deal with his threat of tariffs on steel and aluminum. And this morning, President Trump tweeted about how his focus on maximum sanctions and pressure towards North Korea are achieving results in moving that country towards denuclearization talks. He has not tweeted about a motion filed in court this morning by a lawyer for adult film actress Stormy Daniels to depose Trump about his alleged one-time sexual encounter with her and what role Trump might have played in a $130,000 payment from his lawyer to Daniels to keep her out of the headlines right before the 2016 election. So a lot to chew on. Let's bring in our political strategist this week, Paris Denard, the Republican strategist who served in the George W. Bush White House and who serves on a Trump Advisory Committee on White House Fellowships. Hello, hello, hello.
I beat you to it.
Mm-hmm. And Karine Jean-Pierre, a Democratic strategist who served in the Obama White House. Hi, Karine.
Good afternoon. Hello.
And Karine, start with you. Can't President Trump legitimately make the claim now that his get-tough approach and maybe at times wild language has worked on both trade and on bringing North Korea's Kim to the table with the Chinese, soon with the South Korea, and to talks with President Trump tentatively scheduled right now for May? It worked.
Well, here's the thing about that. You can't wing it in foreign policy. I think Trump spends more time on the golf course than intel briefings. And that shows he's totally unprepared and ill-equipped to deal with serious foreign policy challenges like what we're talking about, North Korea and also Russia. And I think it's incredibly dangerous because he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And he has no interest in real diplomacy or foreign policy. Is his language a little bit better now in what he tweeted today and talked about, you know, diplomacy? Yes. But, you know, I think China had to step in because of the dangerous rhetoric that we keep hearing from this president.
Well, and some are saying, Paris, that China did throw him a curveball, that, you know, they kind of took over this storyline, this narrative. Your thoughts?
My thoughts are just simply this. People just need to give the president credit where credit is due. If he does something that they feel that is bad or negative, there's plenty of blame and plenty of opining about that. But in this case, we have seen that the president's strategy on engagement and maximum pressure with North Korea and the sanctions that he's placed across the country and looking at his engagement, direct engagement with China, is paying off. Do we know what the end result is going to be? No. But we can say without a doubt that the president's strategy and his tactics have resulted in Kim Jong-un saying that he wants to come to the table with President Trump, has him currently in China, and the president has now inked a trade deal with South Korea. So these are important steps and developments. And whether or not we think that it's strategic or not, the point is his tactics are working. And he should get the credit for doing so. Mm.
Well, let's move on to a story that the week began with. Of course, Stormy Daniels claiming on 60 Minutes that several years after her 2006 encounter with Donald Trump, she and her infant daughter were threatened by a man who told her to, quote, leave Trump alone. Now, she's suing to nullify her non-disclosure agreement about the affair. And on CBS This Morning, host Gayle King pressed Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, about his motion to depose the president.
It is well-founded. It was well thought out. It's incredibly documented.
What we want is
the truth. I mean, we want to know the truth about what the president knew, when he knew it, and what he did about it.
Now, Karine, this is something that the president has been publicly ignoring, at least, himself. He hasn't tweeted or anything about it. I mean, how long can he continue to ignore it?
I guess we'll see. I mean, it's amazing. The two people that he doesn't go after is a porn star and a brutal dictator. But look, I think the president's going to learn that the cover-up is usually worse than the crime. Stormy Daniels should get her day in court, and Trump has to be held accountable for his actions, especially if they were indeed illegal. That being said, this story has dominated the headlines for weeks now. But the reality is this is not on top of most Americans' minds, unfortunately.
Yeah,
or fortunate. however you want to look at this. And we should be talking about President's lack of action on, for say, gun control. Look at the kids that we saw coming out this weekend and how amazing that was and how they're moving that conversation forward. And what we're not focusing on is the holding this administration accountable for all the things that they are doing.
But Corinne, we talked to you and Paris and others as strategists. So what do you tell, how do Democrats handle this? Should Democrats be, you know, ginning this up, the Stormy Daniels story? I would imagine that would make people immediately think of Bill Clinton and his indiscretions. And, you know, same with, you know, should they applaud the president about the trade deal because or about possible denuclearization? They want that. But if they do, that's a big win for the president before 2018. So start with how would you advise them to handle the Stormy Daniels story?
Well, I would tell them, let the courts handle that. Keep that in the courts. I don't think it's
that's
an
what
issue.
Nancy Pelosi says. Yeah.
I didn't even hear say that. This is what I've been saying this for a while. Like, I actually don't care about the affair. Now, her being threatened and her daughter being threatened, that is very serious if that is indeed true. And any possible, like, illegal, with the campaign finance issues there, that should be looked into and that will go in the court. I mean, we have to remember she was paid $130,000 11 days before the election. And there are a lot of more questions than answers. But I would leave that to the courts. I think what Democrats need to do is focus on what are they going to do for voters? How are they going to deal with a gun control? What is their policy on that? How are they going to protect folks' health care? They have to talk about the real issues. And that is the most important thing that Democrats need to do in their districts, in their state. And that is the focus that we should have.
So, Paris, I'm wondering what you think about this, because polls this week show that Trump's popularity has not taken a significant hit because of the Stormy Daniels story. One poll from the Associated Press finds that Trump's overall approval rating is up 7 points since last month to 42%, largely due to the economy. I mean, that's still very low for a president at this point in his tenure, but I'm wondering what you conclude from numbers like this.
You conclude that the president is resonating with the American people on his Make America Great Again agenda that is working. People are seeing the results of great economy. They see jobs. They see wages going up. Consumer confidence is up, and they see him being an international leader and doing things that are positive. When looking at the results that he's seeing in South Korea and the engagement with North Korea, I mean, they're seeing things that are working. And so when you have something like Ms. Clifford constantly trying to get more and more 15 minutes of fame without through her attorney at every news outlet that will listen, The American people are saying, we don't care. It doesn't matter. He's the president. Let's move forward.
Well,
these allegations didn't take place while he was president, nor did they take place while he was a candidate, so which is different than Bill Clinton, the President Clinton's allegations while he was a sitting president or while he was governor or while he was attorney general. So I think people are able to separate the wet from the water.
His polling numbers are still an historic low for a president at this point in his tenure. But, you know, Paris, we heard some of Donald Trump's supporters this weekend who watched the 60 Minutes interview. And then I think it was CBS asked them, you know, their thoughts. CNN, rather, asked them their thoughts. Let's listen to a little of that.
Worst case scenario, if he slept with her, whatever. That's between him, the Lord, and his family.
Exactly.
That is not
about
the job he's doing in running our country.
So, Paris, you seem to have a point there. Those are supporters. But at some point, before it's in a courtroom, doesn't Donald Trump have to say, yes, that was my name, whatever the name was, Dave Davies or whatever it was.
That's Dave Dennison.
Yeah, something. That was my name on this agreement. Doesn't he have to be honest about it? What got Bill Clinton in trouble was the definition of is.
That was because he had a court action against him that forced him to testify.
Well, I'm
under
saying
oath.
Might be one against Donald Trump if he's deposed.
I don't see that happening right now. And until something like that happens, he doesn't need to clarify. The only thing he needs to clarify is with his wife. The only thing he needs to clarify is with the first lady. And we should leave it at that. I don't know what and if there are issues regarding a payment that involved Michael Cohen in his capacity as a lawyer, as a friend to the president, he will have to answer to that. But the president does not need to engage in this type of rumor and allegation, because it has nothing to do with
his
presidency.
Hold on, Green. We only got a minute left, and we've spent a lot of time on Stormy Daniels this week. I just want to ask, news this week, the Commerce Department reinstating a citizenship question in the 2020 census. The Democrats saying this is going to narrow our numbers. People won't answer the census. We won't get the funding in states for the people that actually live here. Kareem, what's going to happen here? What would you advise Democrats?
Look, when I heard the 2020 census, this additional question that's been added, that they said that's going to be at the last question, it just brings me back to what I've been thinking about Donald Trump America. And I've said this before: if you're not straight, white, and male, there is no place for you. This is a massive deal that this will reshape not just the country, but our politics in negative ways. It's furthering his policies on discrimination, bigotry, and immigration. And Democrats need to continue to fight this, just like they're doing in California.
Well, let you have the last word. Paris, you're going to have the first one next time. Paris Denard, Republican strategist. Kareem Jean-Pierre, the Democrat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As Easter and Passover approach, we want to listen to the music that traces its roots back to African rhythms, then slaves who found inspiration in the story of Moses freeing his people from bondage in Egypt. It's, of course, gospel music. That's a YouTube video of one of the hottest sounds in gospel right now, the Brooklyn Sound, with Uncle Butch Hayward playing Stay in the Race on the Hammond organ. Let's hopscotch now through some of the history of gospel. It's very dense. We can't possibly get to it all. With Robert Stevens, professor of music at the University of Connecticut. Professor, you've said I can call you Bob. Welcome.
Thank you.
And just let's set out a language here. Gospel grew out of spirituals, which grew out of, sort of the slave sounds, but spirituals and gospel, not the same.
No, they're not. And one of the distinguishing features between the two is that most of the spiritual texts are based on the Old Testament. There was a strong identification with Moses leading his people out of Egypt, out of bondage, and so that possibly may be one of the reasons. The gospel, on the other hand, is about the good news, about Christ coming again. Much of it is based on the New Testament. There are some other factors, too, that I think are important. And one of the things that was not looked upon with great favor during the period of enslavement was the use of instruments. There was this fear that instruments could be used to communicate and inspire uprisings. Mm-hmm. Drums were actually banned, and that played a critical role in how rhythm developed among African Americans in the United States. But although the drums were banned, there were surrogates. One of the primary surrogates to create rhythms were hand clapping and foot stamping.
That's Good Lord, Run Old Jeremiah, recorded by Alan Lomax in 1934. There were also freed slaves. There were Northerners in the late 1700s. A new church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, was formed by former slaves in Philadelphia. The co-founder, Richard Allen, wrote and collected songs for a hymnal in 1801. It was called A Collection of Spirituals, Songs, and Hymns. Let's just listen to one. How Happy Every Child of Grace, sung by the Ebenezer Baptist Church of Rock Hill, South Carolina.
I seek my home in heaven and
one of the things that eventually evolved out of this is the use of refrain lines. It's important to remember that a lot of the folks who attended these services could not read. So audience participation or communal participation, which is conceptually a very African thing, was something that was important to them in the services, and that became a part of what they did.
There were also coded Underground Railroad songs that provided information about how to escape. Here's Wade in the Water.
Wading in the water, wading in the water,
wading.
But you remind us it was after the Civil War that songs like Wade in the Water began to be presented in fundraising concerts by the Fisk University Jubilee Singers. This is a group of former slaves directed by Professor George White. What role did he play in the development of spirituals?
He did two things to them. One, he helped to formalize them. He harmonized them, and he cleaned the language, as he would say, so that it could be understood primarily by whites, because these were the folks who were more likely to contribute money, and it would bring back a bit of nostalgia for them as well.
Here's a 1909 recording of the Fisk Jubilee Singers and Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for the Caribbean.
You say that there was a time when there was a wave of African-American migration, the turn of the 20th century, and songs rooted in slavery were brought to populations that maybe didn't want to dwell on that past as much, and they wanted a more modern, hopeful element to it.
That's true. One of the things that has often plagued music and in the African-American church is this idea of respectability. And so there were people who were just very uncomfortable performing in the old style.
I want to make sure we've mentioned the towering figure in the 1920s and 30s. This is Thomas Dorsey. He wrote the gospel classic, Take My Hand, Precious Lord, after his wife and child died. And let's just listen to a little Mahalia Jackson.
Precious Lord, take my hand.
Thomas Dorsey, known as the father of gospel.
We have to remember that Dorsey was also a blues man initially before he was a religious man. He had to work very hard to be accepted in the church.
Well, it's around this time that the Hammond organ is invented. Here's the Jubilee Gospel Team from the 1920s to 40. You can hear the organ in Let Jesus Lead You.
Let Jesus lead you. Let Jesus lead you. All the way.
You can hear the organ in the back there. Da-da-da-da-da-da. But the organ soon came front and center.
Specifically, the Hammond organ, actually invented because people were looking for an answer to the pipe organ. Again, music making in the black community is vocally oriented, or certainly vocally based, and the Hammond certainly has the ability to approximate what the voice does. In the black church, the spoken word is not the be-all and all. Its significance lies when it's paired with something else. So, as my son Robert III says, a gospel player and a jazz player, said that you have what's called talk music, or padding, as it's called. So during the course of a sermon, as the minister introduces his the text that he wants to teach about, and as the sermon evolves, then the organ player will come in and they have cues. Robert says that he's worked with ministers who beforehand will tell him, this is where I want you to key up. And so they will listen. And then they, as the minister gets to what's called a hoop, they will punctuate that. There's a great example of a sermon close. It's a Pastor H.B. Charles. He's on YouTube, and his sermon is Something Good Is Going to Come Out of This. And as he closes the sermon, you hear the organ player in the background working with him in conjunction. The Hammond does this extremely well.
The way I feel it in my heart, but I just want to tell somebody something good has got to come out of this, because God is real, because his grace grace is sufficient, because his love is everlasting, because his power is...
We began with Uncle Butch Hayward and the Brooklyn Sound. We want to hear Melvin Crispell. He's called the Professor. He also played in the Brooklyn Sound. Let's listen to a little.
Each denomination has its own style of playing, but this is Brooklyn Sound.
Well, you linked to a New York tribute to the Professor when he died. It's played by Corey Henry. It's had over a million views on YouTube. Let's just listen. Gospel today. I know money's being raised for the first major gospel music museum. Can't wait. It's slated for 2 years from now in the Pilgrim Baptist Church on Chicago's South Side. But what's the status now?
Well, gospel is everything to a lot of people now, and it's everywhere. If you think about some of the players who are out there now, there's a player by the name of Doobie Powell. His style, for example... represents or reflects a very R&B orientation. Corey Henry has moved on to a more soloistic orientation. Rob Stevens, my son, I have to mention him, and mm-hmm. Corey Henry's style reflect what might be called progressive gospel. So gospel now has expanded. Its influence is just about everywhere.
Well, again, we know we've skipped over so much of the history. It's huge. You know, everybody has a favorite. We know we left people's out, so I want to hear what it is at hearnow.org. My personal favorite, Yolanda Adams, What Shall I Do? I know Tremaine Hawkins has a fabulous version as well. But let us know yours at hearnow.org. Bob Stevens, again, professor of music at the University of Connecticut. He's a contributor to the forthcoming book, by the way, Songs of Social Protest, International Perspectives. His chapter is Protest in the African-American Experience. It's going to come next summer. Professor Bob, thank you so much for just letting us hear some of this music today.
It's been my pleasure.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, if you think your credit card bill looks bad, according to the Treasury Department, the United States has to borrow nearly $300 billion this week. That's the highest for any single week since the financial crisis in 2008. Now, federal revenues are declining because of Republican tax cuts signed into law late last year. And all of this comes as the U.S. is in the middle of some tense trade negotiations with our biggest creditor, China. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake, and she joins us now with more. Hi there, Maggie.
Hi, Meghna. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. So put this into context for us. $300 billion in 1 week.
Yeah, it's hard to get your head around these numbers. They are so big. And listen, we've had massive deficits for a long time now, to be sure. But certainly some of the policies coming out of Washington, the Trump tax cuts, et cetera, are putting a lot more pressure on that. And now we've got folks saying that figure is going to be about $1 trillion added to the deficit over 10 years. That is just enormous. Now, the Trump administration is arguing that higher economic growth coming as a result of some of these policies will help offset that. And so we may see those numbers change. But right now, that's a forecast and a hope, not a certainty.
Yeah. And all of this is coming as the borrowing costs for the United States are also rising.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we have spending bills out there. they just passed as well. So you put that all together. If you're spending more, you're taking in less revenue, just like our households,
right,
you're going to see this, you know, this turn into a lot of red ink. And that's what has so many people surprised. Remember the Tea Party? I mean, they were all about the deficit, right? The Republicans control both Congress and the White House, and yet we find ourselves in this situation. And some of it is just, you know, the times we're in, and others are policies we're choosing. But at some point, there's going to be a reckoning. And that is what has deficit hawks so concerned.
Right. Okay, so let's bring China into the picture here, right? Because they are our biggest creditor. They own more than $1 trillion of U.S. debt, more than any other foreign country. First of all, why is it that China has decided to hold all this debt from us?
Right. China runs a huge surplus with us. So we pay them dollars for whatever they sell to us, all those goods in your house that say made in China. They need to do something with all that money each month. They could just leave it in cash, hold those dollars, but that's not really practical or efficient, probably safe thing to do. So they reinvest it. And what they buy are U.S. treasuries because they are safe. It's a very liquid, deep market and an easy place for them to park that huge sum of money.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So, like, we buy their goods. They buy our debt so we can buy more of their goods.
Yeah.
Okay. So right now we're negotiating with China after the Trump administration has promised tariffs on some Chinese imports. So if we don't know what's going to happen, but if these negotiations fall through and we do end up in some kind of trade war with China, what might China do with the debt? Like, could they dump some of it?
Yeah, this is where it gets awkward. I mean, it's not specifically on the table, but there's this sort of unspoken threat out there. And China's made a point of saying that all options are on the table. And that carries weight when you own $1 trillion worth of debt. But most analysts we talk to say, listen, this is a nuclear option that Beijing won't use on any large scale sale of treasuries. If they were to dump them, it would hurt the U.S. But more importantly, it would probably destabilize the global economy and hurt China itself. I mean, it's like crippling your biggest customer. So they don't see it as likely. And I think it's interesting. It kind of underscores the fact that even though we're fighting about trade, these two economies are so interdependent on each other.
Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're still waiting for Moscow's response to the expulsion of Russian diplomats from the U.S. and more than 20 countries. Those expulsions follow the nerve agent attack on a former Russian spy and his daughter in the U.K. But there's another story that might have been overshadowed by all the back and forth between Russia and the United States and Europe. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have accused Russian hackers of targeting and penetrating some of the country's most sensitive infrastructure, including power, nuclear, water, and aviation networks. The hackers could have turned off the lights and water for much of the country. Joel Brenner is a former National Security Agency Inspector General and former head of U.S. counterintelligence under the Director of National Intelligence, and he has been warning for some time that something like a Russian hack on our infrastructure could happen. I spoke with Brenner recently, and I began by asking him exactly how the Russians were able to gain access to such critical U.S. infrastructure.
Lots and lots of penetrations of major networks come through the third parties they deal with. Yeah. The vendors, the contractors. Let me give you an example. The Target breach some years ago, which shocked the public, was actually accomplished by importing malware through their heating, ventilation, and air conditioning subcontractor.
Wow.
So that the one looks for, if you're an attacker, you look for the easy place to find. What's the soft underbelly? And that's often not the actual target you're after, but somebody that they deal with on a regular basis and trust. And that's what the Russians have been doing.
So staging malware with those smaller commercial operators, subcontractors, sometimes using systems where logins didn't require two-step verification,
right,
things like that. But I guess we can talk about then what they did afterwards. But it does make me wonder, what you're describing is sort of a low-tech, loosely connected, not very well overseen system of companies and subcontractors but who collectively are in charge of extraordinarily important infrastructure in this country.
Collectively, they are, and individually, some of them are. But even when you're looking at an individual company, not just a sector, you're talking about systems of systems. And those systems of systems are being used by individuals. And very often, the people are the weakest part of the of that system. People click on stuff they shouldn't click on. My old friends at NSA used to say that the weakest link in any system was never the silicon-based unit on the desk. It was the
carbon-based
unit in the chair. That's right. And that's the case here with phishing attacks, for example. Some of these are not individual behavior issues. They're management issues. For instance, not using dual-factor authentication for sensitive systems. That's easy to do.
So ultimately, the hackers collected information pertaining to industrial control systems. So, I mean, Joel Brenner, just not to put too fine a point on it, but is this the government saying that if the Russians had wanted to, they could have turned off the lights?
That's how I read it. I think that we are seeing what in military terms is called preparation of the battle space. In the old days, people talked about preparation of the battlefield. You prepositioned tanks near the border. You moved ammunition up where you'd need it. You did some psychological operations in the territory you were going to attack, for example. Now they talk about the battle space because so much of it is electronic. And I think that what we saw here was the prepositioning of tools that could be used to bring down a particular network.
But would Russia ever really go that far? Because I imagine if they did, I mean, maybe not. There's the spy poisoning in the UK. But like if they did, if they decided to switch off the lights in New York City, wouldn't that be seen in the United States as tantamount to an act of war?
It might be. But here's what I want your listeners to understand. The existence of fundamental vulnerabilities in civilian-controlled critical infrastructure does affect the White House's ability to pull the lever of international power. I'll give you an example. In 2014, when the bank J.P. Morgan was breached, initially it was thought that was a Russian attack. It wasn't. But that's what President Obama thought. And there was a piece in the New York Times in which Obama was quoted as asking his intelligence chiefs whether Putin was sending him the message, a message. That is, was Putin telling Obama, and this was when Ukraine was up in flames, not just smoldering, that if we, the United States, took more forceful action in Ukraine, that Putin was going to take down a major American bank? Now, that's something that the president would have to take into account when deciding how to exercise or whether to exercise our national power, including military power. The game that's being played here now, Meghna, is not open warfare. Mm-hmm. The hostilities are taking place in the gray space between war and peace at the level that is carefully calibrated to be below the level of what the public calls acts of war. So we're seeing things that are hostile, they are expensive, they do hamper us, they hobble us, but they're not things that are going to lead to open warfare. That's the space in which Putin is playing, and he plays his cards very well.
So the notion that the mere possibility of the Russians being able to do something like this, and that that might inform a U.S. national security response is very sobering. But to be fair, the U.S. is playing in this same space too, right? I mean, wasn't it the United States and Israel that unleashed Stuxnet onto Iran and stopped all those centrifuges in Iran?
We should hope that the United States knows how to play very well in this space. And I'm not going to confirm what's widely accepted, that it was the United States and Israel did that. The public information about it certainly looks that way. And all nations that can do it are doing it. This is an area in which we couldn't afford not to be capable. But we are not exercising those capabilities at this point against civilian infrastructures elsewhere.
Well, so this gets us back to sort of what sort of defensive capabilities we ought to be thinking about here regarding our civilian infrastructure. Because I do note, when we talk about power, for example, or any one of these utilities, most of it is not owned by the federal government, right? I mean, these are private sector businesses that may be heavily regulated, but we're leaving a lot of the protections, the defensive protections, up to them, aren't we?
Oh, you're so right. The most frequent number I see is that something on the order of 85% of what we classify as critical infrastructure is privately owned. And in the United States, the government cannot simply issue orders as to how people ought to run their businesses, and we don't want them to do that. So the question is, how do we move that sector or group of sectors toward a more secure posture?
Joel Brenner, last year you told us very clearly that there are multiple recommendations that you forwarded to the Trump administration, one of which was that we have to take critical infrastructure off the public internet. Just like build a wall, but at least build a moat
I think that isolation of critical controls, limited number of critical controls in critical infrastructure, isolating them from the public internet is absolutely essential if we're going to become materially more secure. Now, isolation is a relative term, and rational people can disagree about exactly how to implement that kind of notion. We do see it in some places. For example, in pipeline controls now, we see companies that have analog controls on pipeline pressure so that if the online electronic digital controls were to go haywire and intentionally run up the pressure in a line so that it would explode, you'd have an analog control that would override that. That's an example of an isolated control. You could not find that analog device on the network because it's not there. And if you can't find it, you can't attack it.
Well, Joel Brenner is the former Inspector General of the NSA and head of U.S. counterintelligence in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. He's a senior research fellow at MIT's Center for International Studies. Joel Brenner, thank you so much.
A great pleasure. Thanks.
A Border Patrol agent is on trial in Tucson for murder 5 or so years after he shot through the fence on the U.S.-Mexico border, killing a Mexican teen on the other side who was throwing rocks. Lonnie Schwartz shot 16-year-old Mexican citizen Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez 10 times in 2012 at the border in Nogales, Arizona. In addition to the criminal charges, the boy's family has filed a civil suit. Michel Marisco is senior editor of the Fronteras desk at KJZZ. He's been covering this case. Michel, start with the defense side. What are they saying?
So the defense attorney, Sean Chapman, in this case has made the argument that we are judging this as spectators from, you know, he kept referring to the sanitized confines of this courtroom. He talked about how Lonnie Schwartz heard the, quote, hollow thud of rocks pelting a police canine that was in the area being attacked by the rocks. He talked about the fear and the damage that these rocks could do to people, some blunt force trauma as a result of these types of attacks.
Right.
They can be fairly common.
And they happen frequently because these young people are giving cover for the smugglers after the smugglers have dropped off marijuana on the U.S. side. So they're giving kind of cover by throwing the rocks. But the assistant U.S. attorney, Mary Sue Feldmeier, said in her opening statement, throwing rocks isn't a death penalty offense. But what also are prosecutors saying about these rocks in particular and this fence in particular?
Mexico in that part of the border is actually about 30 feet lower in geography than the United States. So these rocks had to be almost projectiled or catapulted over not just a border fence, but that 30-foot differential. At this point, we're talking about rocks that are being lobbed 50 feet in the air to land in the U.S. What the prosecutors have said in this case is that Agent Schwartz deliberately and calmly walked up amidst this hail of rocks and fired through that 4-inch gap into Mexico. In other words, they were saying there was no danger.
In fact, there's video showing Schwartz, you know, walking up to the fence and firing while other law enforcement looked on. So the prosecutors are saying what? That combination of the rocks having to go up in the air, not being thrown like a baseball, and his calmly walking. What are they saying?
Well, they're saying that this was not a last resort defense, that that there was no immediate danger to anybody.
Yeah. Look, this is a discussion along the border quite a bit. What is the responsibility of border agents when rocks are being thrown at them? It's almost our, you know, Palestinian-Israeli issue. We see Palestinians, you know, throw rocks. And I don't say that flippantly because you have to figure out what to do. And you tell us that there was actually a lawsuit filed in another case where a Border Patrol agent felt he was in danger from someone throwing rocks and 2x4s, and he shot and killed someone, and now admittedly not across the border, but on this side. What did the judge rule then?
The judge ruled that it wasn't appropriate to hold the agent accountable for that case because, you know, at the time he followed the protocols of the U.S. Border Patrol, and the U.S. Border Patrol protocols of that time had found that, look, if you're under that sort of attack, then you need to be able to respond to that.
And so he was cleared. Is that judge's ruling applicable here?
That's going to be an interesting case because, remember, there's also a civil suit involved in all of this, in this particular shooting. And the rules that were restated in 2014, where they discussed rock throwing and when they could shoot, came out in 2014. This particular incident happened in October of 2012. Mm-hmm. So anything that was stated in that policy that gets used could not apply retroactively back to that case. However, that said, in this case, Agent Schwartz is still an agent. You know, he is on leave, but as far as we know, he hasn't been disciplined by the agency for his response in all of this. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's going to become an important point down the road as to whether or not, you know, the agency redraws its rules on whether they can respond when being attacked.
Look, the victim's family, the Mexican family, they've been coming to the trial. What are they saying?
I spoke with the mother briefly earlier this week, and she says, you know, I want my son's death to be avenged. I want justice in this case. I want this man who killed my son to be condemned in the same way that my son has been condemned. She hasn't said whether or not she's looking for, you know, any form of capital punishment. But she has been saying this for several years now. She wants this case to be done, and she wants Lonnie Schwartz to face the ultimate punishment, whatever that may mean in her own mind.
Well, that's Michel Marisco, senior editor of the Fronteras Desk at KJZZ. We'll keep following this trial in Tucson. Michel, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.